Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, I'm talking transhumanism with writer Mark O'Connell and his book, To Be a Machine. Mark O'Connell is a journalist, essayist and literary critic from Dublin. He is a books columnist for Slate, a staff writer at The Millions, and a regular contributor to The New Yorker's Page Turner blog and The Dublin Review. And his work has been published in the New York Times Magazine, the New York Times Book Review, and The Observer. And Mark's first book is To Be a Machine, Adventures Among Cyborgs, Utopians, Hackers, and the Futurists Solving the Modest Problem of Death, which is published now by Grant and Mark. Welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks very much for having me.
What's the idea behind To Be a Machine?
Well, the book is about transhumanism, which is this movement predicated on the idea that we can and we should use technology to kind of push out the boundaries of the human condition, up to and including literally becoming immortal. So that's kind of the milieu that I'm investigating in the book. But it also takes in lots of other things, like sort of my own anxieties about mortality and death and technology and capitalism and America, and all these sort of disparate sort of concerns come into the book as well. But it is fundamentally a sort of a journalistic investigation of this movement.
So when did you first become aware of the movement? Why were you interested in it?
I wrote a piece for a magazine maybe 8 or 9 years ago now, a magazine that I wrote for after college in Dublin called Mongrel. And it was a very short, not very in-depth piece, just sort of like, there's this movement, there's these kind of people with these crazy ideas, here they are. So it was quite a short piece, but it, for whatever reason, it never really went out of my head. And I kept sort of reading things about it over the years, and it would come back into my mind. But really what happened, and I talk about it in the first chapter of the book, I became a father about 4 years ago. And whatever it was about the experience of just early parenthood, I think like witnessing my wife give birth and like holding this tiny, fragile human being in my hands for the first time. And I just became, along with all the sort of joyful stuff about being a parent, I became sort of morbidly obsessed with the fragility of like our lives in these bodies and the kind of overarching sort of reality of mortality. And so I think really what happened was at this time, I kind of became obsessed again with transhumanism and started reading a lot about it and thinking a lot about it. And I think really what it was a way of like, a psychoanalyst would probably call it a process of sublimation, where I was channeling these kind of anxieties through this obsession with this movement that offered or seemed to offer a way out of this kind of condition. So for me, that's one of the kind of interesting things about being a writer, is that a subject matter is always a way of writing about other things. It's always a kind of an excuse or an occasion to write about these sort of vast array of anxieties and concerns. So transhumanism certainly kind of offered that for me.
Before we get on to transhumanism proper, I want to talk about robots, first of all, and where we are with robots now, I guess, before we talk about what might happen with them in the future. And in the book, you attend this event, the DARPA Robotic Challenge, which is this sort of, well, I'll get you to describe it, but it's like a sort of televised sport event almost.
Yeah, that was one of the most fun experiences I had while writing the book, actually. It was a two-day event in Pomona, just outside of Los Angeles, and it's organised by DARPA. DARPA is the sort of advanced research arm of the Pentagon, essentially. And the idea of it was that they sort of gathered all the sort of most sophisticated and most sort of advanced robotics groups in the country and across the world to compete on this kind of assault course scenario. And the idea behind it was that in sort of humanitarian sort of catastrophe situations like Fukushima, say, where it's very dangerous for human beings to go into these situations, that it would be very useful to have humanoid robots who could automated sort of, you know, autonomous humanoid robots that could negotiate these scenarios. And so what you had essentially was like an assault course set up where you had robots like driving cars, clambering over rubble, trying to sort of open doors. And it was, yeah, it was set up almost like a kind of a sporting event, like sort of gladiators or something. And so there was a really sort of self-conscious funness about the event, which for me was fascinating, but also kind of, it was very difficult to ignore the kind of underlying militaristic kind of subtext of all of this. And obviously there's a humanitarian kind of rhetoric around it, but ultimately you're talking about DARPA, you're talking about the Pentagon, so there's always this sense that these are the people who developed drones, these are the people who developed GPS as a war technology, and you know they're kind of explicitly interested in transhuman technologies for purposes of war. So there's a real dark subtext to this in the way that I write about it in the book.
And we'll come back to DARPA and what else they might be doing a bit later on, but these robots, I mean, you talk about them, you know, going into Fukushima and stopping some sort of nuclear meltdown. At the minute, I wouldn't send them out to get me a coffee. They're like comically bad
at
doing things that are second nature to, I think, as somebody, there's a famous aphorism in the book that you mentioned, that they basically can't do things that like a one-year-old child could do.
Right. It's more of X paradox is what you're thinking of.
Yeah. So what's wrong with them? What are the things that robots struggle to do that are second nature to humans?
Well, the paradox there is that things that are extremely difficult for us, like calculations, is very easy for machines to do, and things that we don't even think about, like, you know, walking in here to the studio and pulling out a chair, opening a door, incredibly complicated things, actually, even for ourselves, we just do them unconsciously. To watch robots trying to do these things is extraordinary. I mean, it's comic, for sure, but it also makes you realise we're kind of geniuses without knowing it. We do these incredibly kind of sophisticated, complicated things all the time. And you know, my son was learning to walk when I was at this thing, so I was seeing him reflected in the robots trying to sort of negotiate these difficult physical spaces. It seems quite clear that we are quite a long way off having, like, you know, autonomous robots who can sort of drive cars and negotiate difficult situations as humans would. But the thing to remember, and the thing that I kind of was struck by and write about in the book, is that the first DARPA challenge was in, I think, I could be wrong, but I think it was in 2003, and it was cars. So it was self-driving cars, and most of the sort of self-driving cars that were built for that challenge got, like, they got nowhere on the course. They got like 200, 250 meters. The car that got furthest overturned and sort of got halfway through the course or whatever. But then, you know, Google got involved, and very, very quickly self-driving cars became a sort of a plausible project, and we're seeing kind of the development of that now. So, yeah, sort of autonomous human robotics might not be as far off as you would think watching those robots fall on their arses.
But none of these robots, this is not, you know, Robot Wars off the telly where it's some guy in his shed. These are all multi-million pound things. So how far away do you think we are for them actually being useful?
Well, it depends on what you mean by useful. I think, like, the kinds of uses that you would, like, they're sort of explicitly inserting them into in the DARPA Robotics Challenge, it's really difficult to say. It looks like they're a long way off, but technology tends to develop at this sort of very slow for a long time, and then all of a sudden it gets very sophisticated very quickly. I would find it difficult to say. I mean, I do, like, look into those kind of trends and stuff in the book, but my sort of interest in the book is never really trying to predict the future. I don't have the tools to do that, and it's not really what I'm trying to do as a writer. I'm more interested in the people who are predicting the future and the people who are, like, sort of fully invested in the future.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
You mentioned that one of the things that's underlying the ideas that you talk about in the book is the politics of it, the politics of the people that are creating these things, that care about them, the tech billionaires that are putting the money into a lot of these technologies. And with, you know, the advance of robots, one of the obvious things is that there's a whole raft of jobs that are supposedly going to become obsolete, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I came out of the book very rattled by, you know, during the experience of reporting it. I kept, you know, most of the conversations that I was having and most of the people I was talking to were talking about very sort of remote, very kind of radical and sort of speculative ideas about the future of the merger of, you know, humans and machines and sort of uploading ourselves to super intelligent AI and all those sorts of things. But the thing that frightened me most was something that I think is unarguably coming quite soon, which is this whole new wave of automation that'll come from artificial intelligence. And that's, for me at least, a very kind of unsettling and quite bleak vista on the near to medium term future.
although the whole sort of like Skynet AI sort of idea is like, we think it's a, you know, it's a thing from science fiction. Mm. There are people out there that are working on, not many, not enough, but some people that are out there working on these scenarios. You talked to a guy called Nick Bostrom. Mm-hmm. So tell us what he's doing.
Yeah, well, Nick Bostrom is a philosopher, and he's the director of a sort of a futurist think tank or research group in Oxford called the Future of Humanity Institute. And Nick is, he would not describe himself as a transhumanist. I think he's no longer really a part of that movement, but he certainly was back in the 90s and early 2000s a very sort of formative figure in transhumanism. He's since kind of moved away from it into a kind of, he jokes about being more of a Luddite now, because he's the kind of person who's laid out the sort of the dangers of really advanced AI and what could happen as a result of developing superhuman artificial intelligence. And the idea is that, to put it very sort of bluntly and maybe oversimplistically, that the danger is that a superhuman AI might well sort of treat us in a way quite similar to how we've treated kind of lower life forms. And it's not a completely absurd fear to have when you look at like how things go in the sort of, you know, evolutionary food chain. You know, you invent something that's much, much smarter than you, it's quite possible that it's not going to go well for you.
And there's this, what's the sort of thought experiment about the paperclip manufacturing? Tell us that.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, Nick Bostrom's book, Superintelligence, he comes up with this, I think, sort of self-consciously quite absurd and cartoonish sort of illustration of how this might play out. But I think it's, like, it's a really sort of compelling sort of thought experiment, because it sort of, it acknowledges that, the scenario that he's laying out is basically you have an artificial intelligence that is owned by a paperclip manufacturer. And if you're a paperclip manufacturer, you're going to sort of train your AI on how do you most efficiently and, you know, productively make paperclips, and how do you make as much paperclips as possible and as much profit as possible. And you just point the AI in that direction. You say, solve this problem. And so the AI's way of doing that would be very different to our own, much less nuanced in a way. And so what the AI would do would be maybe turn everything in the world into paperclips and paperclip manufacturing facilities. So, you know, it's obviously a very cartoonish way of thinking about this problem, but I think the underlying concern is not that artificial intelligence would be malicious. It's not a sort of a Skynet, you know, Terminator type scenario where we create this Frankenstein type thing and it comes after us out of vengeance or whatever. Why did you create me? It's that computers are, I mean, the way I think of it when I was looking at this stuff, it's actually not artificial intelligence that's the problem, it's artificial stupidity. So, you know, a computer thinks about things in a very different, very kind of sort of hardline rationalistic way. And so one of the other examples that was given to me was by Stuart Russell, who's a professor of AI at Berkeley. And his sort of argument is that, well, say you have an AI and you train it on curing cancer. And the AI's way of doing that, the most sort of straightforward and logical way of doing that, would be to wipe out every life form on Earth on which it's possible for the abnormal division of cells to occur. So then you've suddenly wiped out all life. And again, it's like, it's a very extreme example, but there are problems inherent in the sort of, in the concept of artificial superintelligence. I was never fully convinced that this was a realistic thing to be worried about. There were moments where I was like, you know, I spent a lot of time in rooms with people who were sort of vastly more intelligent than I was. So there was a sort of a kind of a mise en abyme there of like, you know, am I the human and they're the superintelligence? But the thing is that, like, I was always kind of a bit skeptical about my own skepticism. I would think, you know, this is crazy. Why are we worried about this when we have, you know, climate change and, you know, vast wealth inequality to worry about? But at the same time, I couldn't totally discount it, because these are people who truly understand AI and how it works, and think that there's something to be worried about there. Not that it's something that's necessarily going to happen or even likely to happen, but if it were to happen, and even if it's just a small sliver of a possibility, it would be absolutely catastrophic. So it's worth thinking about, and that's where sort of people like Nick Bostrom and Stuart Russell are coming from.
As we go into the next part of the show, I want to start talking about, you know, mind mapping and sort of brain simulation. But to get us there, I think this is a good point to bring up the idea of the singularity. A thing that I think now tends to be associated with Ray Kurzweil, but I think you mentioned that it predates him.
Yeah, I mean, the singularity, I mean, it arguably comes out of not philosophers or futurists, but science fiction. But again, it was formulated, first of all, by people thinking about artificial intelligence. And I mean, the singularity is almost like the sort of less bleak version of what we've just been talking about. So the idea is that at a certain point, and this is certainly how Kurzweil talks about it, and he is the most sort of, he's the sort of popularizer of the singularity, the kind of high priest of the idea. And he describes it as, well, we're going to get to, at a certain point, we're going to get to human level AI. You know, at that point, it's, he bases it on the idea of the exponential. And, you know, very shortly afterwards, we're going to get to superhuman AI, and the AI will be able to kind of program itself and make itself more sophisticated. And then he takes this leap into what seems to me to be a basically kind of religious idea, that at this point, sort of an eschatological notion, that at this point everything changes. It's a kind of, it's an end times sort of prophecy. Everything changes. We will reach such a point of sophistication in our technology that we'll be able to upload our minds to machines, and we'll be able to merge with artificial superintelligence and become disembodied, or like multiply embodied superhuman intelligent beings, and we won't sort of have to deal with these bodies, we won't have to die, everything will change. And so that's kind of the basic notion of the singularity. He says it's going to happen in 2045. This is what, I mean, he has a quite impressive track record of predicting technological change, but I'm not sure how seriously this notion of the singularity happening at all, but certainly in 2045 is taken, even among the more faithful transhumanists. I think he's seen as being, well, you know, he's got some interesting ideas, and the reason why he sort of gets so much airtime, I think, is because he's saying that this is going to happen in our lives, in our lifetimes. But yeah, it's pretty far out there, pretty sort of almost, I think, explicitly religious.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Mark O'Connell, and we're talking about his book, To Be a Machine. And Mark, in the first part, you mentioned Moravec's paradox. I want to talk about Hans Moravec a bit, because he's somebody who believes that one day, as you've just been mentioned when talking about the singularity, that we're going to be able to basically upload our minds to something to liberate us from, and I say these words quite self-consciously, liberators from the prison of our bodies. Tell us something about him and his idea.
Yeah, well, he's a roboticist at Carnegie Mellon. And so Moravec outlines this scenario in one of his books whereby, and it's quite sort of gruesomely detailed, he's talking about the brain being scanned by an AI robot, and the sort of the actual grey matter being removed from the skull as it's scanned and sort of thrown away. And so there's this really quite explicit idea that our bodies are just meat, and that we happen to be substantiated right now in this sort of meat machine, is another phrase that keeps coming up in transhumanism, but that what we really are is a consciousness, and that consciousness can potentially be run on any substrate, not just the substrate of the human body, but sort of any kind of machine. So yeah, and there's an implicit kind of sense that once that happens, we will be liberated from our humanity, our kind of fallen state. So there's all kinds of connections between this stuff and various sort of forms of religious discomfort with the body. One of the comparisons I make in the book, and I would not be the first to make this comparison, is with the sort of early Christian heresy of Gnosticism. Their belief was that we were trapped in the flesh, and that the flesh was evil, and that we were kind of a divine spirit that needed to escape from the flesh. And so, I mean, transhumanists are aware of these kind of connections. They're not terribly comfortable talking about them, because they tend to be very extreme rationalists, and for them, any kind of sense that there's a connection with religion, or that there might be a religious dimension to their thinking, is troubling, and they don't really want to go there.
There's also a lot of parallels, or, you know, wholesale stealing from sort of liberation movements, of like the transgender movement, for instance. It seems like a lot of these people genuinely seem to think that we're trapped in these bodies, and these bodies are wrong.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more prominent transhumanists is a woman named Martine Rothblatt, who I think is the highest paid CEO in America. She founded the company Sirius, which is the satellite radio company, but she's transgender, and she talks about transhumanism sort of through her own experience with being transgender. It's interesting. I'm not sure how convincing it is, but you do. I mean, it is a kind of a rhetoric that comes up with various transhumanists that you talk to. There's a guy I spent time with from my book, Tim Cannon, who's a sort of self-proclaimed cyborg. He runs this company called Grindhouse Wetware in Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania. And he and his colleagues design and build technologies for implanting inside themselves to give them sort of superhuman capabilities. But these guys, and Tim in particular, is really sort of really extreme in the way that he talks about wanting to escape from the condition of embodiment, wanting to be out of his kind of animal form. And yeah, when I talked to him, he used quite a lot of rhetoric that was sort of borrowed from the language of transgender people, which is, I mean, I can see where he's coming from. He would say that, you know, transgender people say that they're born in the wrong body, and he would say that, well, we're all born in the wrong body. I'm in the wrong body because I'm in a body at all. And so, yeah, I kind of passed over that more or less unremarked, but I think it's fairly obvious that that would be sort of troubling to transgender people. And I've spoken to trans people who've read the book, and they've found that part particularly kind of difficult to swallow, I think, understandably.
I wanted to get to Tim Cannon later on, but we may as well talk about those guys now. So as you said, you know, they describe themselves as a cyborg. You said that, you know, their idea is to give ourselves superhuman abilities, which makes it sound like the X-Men or something. But, I mean, realistically, what they're doing is, like, removing the worry of ever having to lose your Oyster card or whatever at the moment, aren't they? Where are they going with that?
Well, it's very mildly superhuman capabilities at the moment. I mean, the guys that I was hanging out with, they all had sort of chips in their hands that allowed them to open their laboratory door. So that, you know, you could just sort of wave your hand and the door would open. One of the guys, Marlo, who's this young Australian fella who'd come over from Western Australia to work with Grindhouse, had a chip in his hand, but he hadn't got clearance yet. So the chip was just sort of sitting there waiting to become useful. And so that was about as far as he'd got in terms of becoming a cyborg. But for these guys, like, it's like they're aware that these technologies are, you know, not primitive, but they're not, like, terribly sophisticated. And, you know, a lot of this stuff you could do with a phone, and you wouldn't need sort of unlicensed surgery to do that. But for them, it's kind of, like I describe it in the book, as a kind of a performance art gesture in a way. It's a sort of a gesture towards the sort of the notion of becoming, you know, embodied in something other than flesh. And they're really serious about this, and they want to be uploaded minds in machines.
I want to talk about what that would actually involve. And I don't mean necessarily the technology, but I guess why they want to do it. Like, everything I can think of that makes being human fun is to do with some sort of, like, sensory thing, whether it's touching somebody or eating something or whatever. What is there to do if you're basically just a piece of software in an incredibly powerful mainframe somewhere?
Right. Well, I mean, I had a lot of these conversations where I would say some version of what you're saying with transhumanists, and always what I kept sort of hitting up against eventually was what I saw as, like, a really extreme sort of mechanistic view of what it actually means to be human. So that they would say, you know, if you make that argument, a lot of transhumanists would say, but that you are just a machine. So, you know, your pleasure response is a response to a stimulus, and that's a basically machinic kind of way of being in the world. And, you know, to, like, transport that over to a more sophisticated machine is not, like, inherently impossible or undesirable. But so you're right. I mean, like, I found myself being backed into kind of positions of, like, being quite conservative in terms of, like, you know what, death is good. It's good that we're in these bodies and that we're mortal and that we sort of, you know, become decrepit over time and we die. I don't know if I necessarily believe that, actually. I'm still pretty uncomfortable about sort of death and degradation. But there is something that I found myself sort of coming closer to when I was writing the book, that, you know, if there is meaning in life, it is from being embodied. It is from bodily kind of mammalian meaning. And it has to do with the fact that we die, that we're only here for a short time, and that, you know, we're fragile, and, you know, love is a bodily thing. But so, like, it's difficult because they would look at me and say, yeah, but, you know, you can translate that to a machine. That's not a problem. We'll get there eventually. So yeah, it's difficult to kind of defend your sort of humanism against transhumanists.
Let's perhaps talk a little bit about how we get there. So you talked to a guy, Randall Cohn, who's working on this idea of whole brain emulation. Yeah. What would that involve?
Well, so Randall is he's a computational neuroscientist. He's Dutch, but he works in Silicon Valley, unsurprisingly now. But his whole kind of life's work is around sort of defining the possibilities and the prospects for extracting consciousness from the substrate of the brain. And so, yeah, he describes himself as an architect, in that he doesn't do original research, but he kind of collates research that's being done by other scientists and puts it together and sort of makes connections between scientists working in various relevant fields like brain scanning and digital microscopy and these kinds of things. And his sort of whole work is predicated on the idea that consciousness, the mind, is reducible to information, that everything we are, all our kind of emotions and memories and feelings, it's all reducible to like the firing of neurons and the connections between neurons. And you can kind of, you can represent that as data, and that data is transferable to computational code and can be run on some other substrate other than the brain. So it just so happens that the machine on which we're run right now is the brain, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't run on anything else. So yeah, there's a lot of kind of, there's some serious sort of scientific questions around like how viable this is. And I think the scientific consensus would be that it's at best a very, very remote possibility that you could translate the brain into code. But I did speak to some scientists who felt that it was at least theoretically possible and that Randall was not out of his mind, as it were.
But there are plenty of neuroscientists who think that this is nonsense.
Yeah, I would say most neuroscientists. I mean, I didn't talk by any means to like a huge number of neuroscientists, but the impression I get is that they don't take this stuff all that seriously. There are some who do enough to kind of to sort of rattle that consensus, but it's certainly a very remote kind of theoretical possibility. But Randall has dedicated his life to figuring out how it might be done.
But again, this is one of those things that, and these will keep cropping up as we, especially as we get into the, you know, the sort of attempts to beat death.
Yeah.
As we go along, there's a lot of money being put into this. You know, there are tech billionaires out there that, obviously, for rather obvious reasons, we don't need to go into,
yeah,
want to live forever.
Yeah.
And so this is not some minority thing. There's serious money going into this.
Serious money, yeah. Like real, real money, real Silicon Valley money. The first thing I heard about transhumanism actually was years and years ago. I did an interview with Steve Call, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, wrote that book, Ghost Wars. And he was, I think just as an aside, talking about a party that he'd been at in Silicon Valley. And it was sort of towards the end of the evening and people were sort of standing out on the balcony and there was all these like quite young people who had made just billions through mainly Google. And, you know, the question came up, so what are you going to do next? You're 35 or whatever, you've made all your money, what are you going to do next? And a couple of them said, well, we need to look at the problem of mortality. We need to figure out how we can kind of, you know, stick around long enough to spend all this money, basically. And so that was the first kind of thing that I heard about transhumanism. So, you know, immediately it was linked to this broader culture of kind of sort of techno-libertarianism and the sort of radical belief in the possibilities of technology to solve every problem, including death. So there's big money being plowed into this stuff. Google, back in 2014, set up this biotechnology research firm called Calico, which is explicitly aimed at sort of pushing out the horizon of mortality. I mean, they're not talking about making us immortal machines or anything. It's quite respectable science that's being done there. But they are looking at how we can sort of push back the boundaries of mortality. And Peter Thiel is another very strong example of, I mean, it almost got to the point where when I was writing the book that Thiel started to seem like the unacknowledged kind of protagonist of the book, or at least his money did. His money was everywhere. All the people I talked to, all the technologies I was looking at, all the research I was looking into, his venture capital funds, various sort of arms were in all of this stuff. And so, yeah, Thiel is sort of radically invested, literally, in the prospect for immortality, particularly his own immortality seems to be what he's most interested in.
And then to bring us back to, you know, Tim Cannon and those sort of grinder guys, and more specifically bringing back in DARPA, and, you know, we talked about that, the fun side of DARPA that you went and witnessed at the sort of Robot Wars thing. DARPA's heavily invested in this idea of like body modification, super soldiers, things like that, the idea of, you know, making soldiers that don't have to sleep and things like that, for instance, aren't they? And this always seems to come back to weapons research.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing because, like, most transhumanists are, I wouldn't say most transhumanists are libertarians, but there's definitely, like, a strong vein of libertarianism running through this, as there is in Silicon Valley generally. And so, like, Thiel's a really strong example of that. But the biggest investor in transhumanism is the US government through DARPA, just as Thiel's biggest contracts are with the government. Yeah, I think, like, if this stuff happens, I would not discount the influence of DARPA there. I mean, it's difficult to know exactly what they're doing, but, yeah, a lot of it does involve, like, they're very interested in the sort of possibility of merging, you know, machine intelligence with humans. But I think it's like as extreme as this stuff seems, like you can't discount how much of our technology that we use every day is a direct result of these crazy projects that DARPA have thrown themselves at in the past. I mean, the internet literally is the result of the DARPA kind of research project in the 60s. And I even like found my way here to this remote place in London by GPS, which is originally a sort of technology of war developed by DARPA. So, you know, these are, in a sense, kind of superhuman technologies. I have like a sort of a superhuman navigational capability that I would absolutely not have if it weren't for DARPA. So, yeah, these are war technologies that become kind of part of how we live our everyday lives.
And again, it seems perfectly fine having that thing in the palm of my hand rather than embedded into my wrist.
Yeah, I'm fine with that too, yeah. But I think, like, the grinders or whatever would... I mean, it's actually not that radical when you think about it. They want the same technology, they just don't want to have to use the phone. They just want it inside themselves. And so, yeah, there are technologies you can get that allow you to sense magnetic north or whatever. I wouldn't give up my phone for it, though, that's for sure.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Mark O'Connell. We're talking about his book, To Be a Machine. And Mark, I want to move us on then to the transhumanist idea of, not necessarily through mind uploads and things, but living longer, fighting death and beating death by just making human beings live hundreds of years or 1,000 years. Let's start this off actually going back to a sort of 1950s, 1960s idea of living forever, cryogenics. Mm. You go to this place, Alcor. Tell us something about that facility.
Well, yeah, so this was one of the first things I did for the book is I went to this place called Alcor Life Extension Foundation, which is just outside of Phoenix in Arizona. And it's I think, the largest of the world's four cryonics facilities. There's three in Russia and... there's three in the States, one in Russia. It's a cryonics preservation facility. Cryonics is basically the science, or a lot of people would say pseudoscience, of preserving recently deceased human beings with a view to, at some point in the future, maybe 50 years, maybe 500 years, when the technology becomes sophisticated enough, reanimating those corpses. They don't call them corpses, they call them patients, in fact, because within the sort of logic of cryonics, these people are not seen as dead, they're seen as being sort of suspended in a liminal sort of stasis between
they have the oldest man in the world there.
Right, so one of the things that I saw there was a cryonics pod from the late 60s, and there's a plaque saying this is where the first person was cryonically preserved. And the guy, Max Moore, who oversees the facility, he's a kind of a philosopher of transhumanism. He's British, but he's sort of got himself into this sideline of running a cryonics facility as kind of almost like a public service in a way, because it's a way to kind of ensure, from their point of view, that you get to the sort of transhuman future or whatever. But yeah, what he said to me was that, well, this is, you know, technically the oldest person in the world. And I said, well, hardly, that's, you know, he's dead, isn't he? And he's like, no, he's not dead, he's preserved. So, yeah, there's quite a sort of, there's a real sort of breakdown in how things are viewed by transhumanists and non-transhumanists. But yeah, cryonics is, well, it's hugely controversial to the point of not being taken seriously at all by mainstream science. But the interesting thing is that transhumanists, or, you know, cryonicists, they don't see it as being by any means a dead cert. They sort of look at it as maybe it works. You know, even if there's a small chance, it's better than nothing. It's better than sort of rotting away in the ground. So I'll take it.
But it does almost seem, when we go on now to talk about, you know, some of the other ideas of the transhumanists, that cryonics is like a redundant technology, because as far as they're concerned, I mean, you talk to Aubrey de Grey, who's a big name in that world. And, well, let's talk about this idea of longevity escape velocity,
right?
This sort of philosophy. What does that mean?
Well, longevity escape velocity is this idea that Aubrey de Grey, who's a biogerontologist, again, a very controversial figure, but sort of a figure of real hope for transhumanists. And it's this idea that, basically, I'm going to have to oversimplify it, I think, because my sort of level of understanding of it is fairly primitive. But I think basically the way Aubrey describes it is that for every, like, if you push out the sort of horizon of mortality by more than a year for every year that passes, you effectively get to a situation where you outrun death. So, yeah, the idea is that you would, every year, 5 years or however long, you would go and get a series of treatments done, and you would sort of push out your own longevity by another 5 or 10 years or whatever. But
and then within that 5 or 10 years, the technology would come on even further.
It keeps getting more and more sophisticated. And yeah, so Aubrey, there's sort of two tracks almost to sort of immortality for transhumanists. Aubrey's kind of version would be staying alive within your own sort of flesh and blood human body, and sort of, you know, the upkeep of the machine of the body is something that he thinks can be achieved. Whereas the other kind of more radical, and I think probably more common view with transhumanists, is that you leave behind the body altogether and you become sort of a disembodied, or, you know, embodied in a robot or whatever, super intelligence. So those two things are not necessarily incompatible. I think a lot of transhumanists would say that, well, let's just go with Aubrey until we get to the singularity, and then we jump ship and become sort of immortal super intelligences. And also cryonics, even though a lot of transhumanists don't necessarily buy into cryonics, it's seen as maybe a way of getting to that point. If you die too soon to sort of benefit from the singularity, maybe cryonics will be the thing that gets you there. So it's a series of sort of bet hedgings.
And again, as we mentioned before, this is a thing where there's serious Silicon Valley money being put into these technologies. You talk to a young woman scientist, Laura Deming, who's literally working on ways in which we can retard death, advance aging. What is she doing?
Yeah, Laura's a pretty extraordinary person. She's very young. She's, I think, probably the youngest person I talked to for the book. She's 21, but she's she dropped out of college at, I think, 17 or 18. 17, I think. She was offered a ton of money by Peter Thiel to drop out of college and start a venture capital fund specifically aimed at investing in the life extension space. So she runs this venture capital fund out of San Francisco that invests in technologies and sort of medical innovations that might be used for extending lifespans. But she is, I don't think she would describe herself as a transhumanist, and she's very sort of measured in how she talks about her work and the kinds of things that she's investing in. But she kind of hinted at various points that she sort of tones it down in order not to seem like a starry-eyed lunatic for, you know, potential business partners and stuff like that. But she is absolutely driven by this sort of anxiety and terror about death. I mean, she talked about when she was like 7 or 8 years old, her grandmother coming to visit and trying to play with her grandmother and realizing that her grandmother couldn't play with her because she was really old, and then sort of became apparent that her grandmother was going to die, and she had this like real sort of revelation that, oh my God, like, this is something that happens to everyone and it needs to be addressed. And she decided at a very young age that she was going to dedicate her life to solving this problem. So there's a real sense among transhumanists that death is like a problem. It's an issue that needs to be dealt with, and we need to throw as much money and as much smarts and as much resources as we can at this problem. And if we do, like everything else, we'll solve it.
I want to talk about one other person, Zoltan Istvan, who's, we could tell us who he is, but he's basically taken it upon himself to popularise, shall we say, the ideas of transhumanism.
Yeah, Zoltan's like a fascinating guy. He was one of the first people I met when I started reporting on the book. I met him at this conference in the Bay Area on transhumanism and religion. And at that point, he was kind of a nobody in the movement. He was sort of an interloper. He'd just written this book called The Transhumanist Wager, which is sort of a deeply unwieldy sort of Ayn Rand-style novel of ideas about transhumanism. And yeah, he was sort of trying to establish himself within the movement. And I got to know him and I really sort of liked him. He's very personable, very kind of charismatic guy who has this extraordinary kind of life story. He left, you know, when he graduated from college, he studied philosophy in Colombia, and he fixed up a boat and just stocked it with sort of classic Russian novels and sailed around the world and sort of paid his way by doing reports for National Geographic and so on. And so he's this really kind of like almost like an embodiment of this sort of American ideal of the self-made man. But not that long after I sort of first got to know him, he decided he was going to run for president in that way that Americans sometimes do, just as a way to kind of achieve this version of yourself. Well, screw it, I'll just run for president. So yeah, his idea was that he was going to form a transhumanist political party, and he was going to be the candidate, and that he was going to run on a platform of sort of raising awareness about the problem of mortality and the need to sort of divert government funds into investing in solutions for mortality. So what Zoltan did was he bought it's a 1977 Bluebird Wander Lodge, like an old sort of classic American school bus that you see in all those films, and he converted it into like a giant coffin. He put all these kind of bits and pieces on it to make it look like a huge coffin driving along the highway, and drove across the continental United States from San Francisco, which is where he lives, to Florida, and then up to Washington, D.C. The original idea was that he was going to nail a transhumanist bill of rights to the door of the rotunda of the Capitol building, which is, I think, was an allusion to Martin Luther, the 95 Theses. But so yeah, he became quite a big deal subsequently. He became kind of a media personage, and I joined him for part of his campaign, traveled across Texas with him, which was, yeah, it was incredibly fun and weird.
And this, of course, annoys most of the other transhumanists.
Yeah, he's viewed with like suspicion, not to say contempt, by the sort of the establishment transhumanists. And that was one of the things that sort of Zoltan was very preoccupied by in the time that I spent with him, was like this sort of tension between him and the establishment. And yeah, I think there's a lot of sort of resentment because he was getting a huge amount of media coverage, and he was suddenly out of nowhere becoming the face of transhumanism. And people who'd been in this space for, you know, decades were kind of like, where did this guy come from? But, you know, it's a classic example of like, he's a charismatic guy, he's quite good looking, he's plausible looking, he's a good talker, and, you know, the media just love him. And the same reason that I was sort of drawn to spend time with him and write about him, he's just a fascinating guy, and that's what sort of sold him to people.
Well, it's amazing that this guy is out there trying to popularise the idea, make people aware that this is a thing that people are doing. But again, ultimately, and again, as you mentioned throughout the book, the people that are behind this are the Peter Thiels of the world. Ultimately, the question is, who is going to get to live forever? It's going to be the super rich.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's unquestionable. And that's a conversation that I had many times with transhumanists, and they're not convinced that that's the case. They want to believe, and they do believe, that these technologies will ultimately be available to everyone. What you get almost is a kind of a version of like sort of just good old-fashioned trickle-down economics, that, you know, these technologies will, you know, at first be only available to the super rich, to the Peter Thiels and the, you know, Eric Schmidt or whatever. And then, you know, just like iPhones got cheaper or more available, these technologies will become available to all of us and we'll all be able to live forever. But I think to sort of lay my cards on the table, I think it's highly unlikely that anyone is going to live forever, even Peter Thiel. But if these technologies do become available, I think it's going to be those people who will reap the benefits. There's an extraordinary profile in The New Yorker that was written of Peter Thiel back in, I think, 2011. And the journalist writing the profile sort of brings up exactly this question. Like, why are you so invested in this idea of death as a problem that needs to be solved when there are all these other issues? Like, you know, surely what's going to happen if we do get to a point where people can become immortal, it's just going to increase the already kind of pretty vast sort of social inequalities that are already there in society. And obviously Peter Thiel is the last person you should be saying that to, because, you know, he just doesn't care about that stuff. But what he said was, well, the most radical form of inequality that there is inequality between people who are living and people who are dead, which is really, like, bizarre, amazing, sort of revealing thing to say, I think. But that's how a lot of transhumanists do view it. It's, you know, we just need to think of it for what it is, which is a humanitarian catastrophe. It just so happens that it's the one form of, like, inequality that is actually, you know, it's the great leveler, obviously. You know, we're all equally subject to death. So, yeah, it makes sense that Peter Thiel would want to eradicate that.
Yeah, I mean, basically what he's saying is, you know, why bother trying to deal with global warming? I'm just going to upload myself to a computer and sod off into space because right. I can afford to.
Yeah, and failing that, he's got a compound down in New Zealand that he's got all lined up and ready to go, and a helicopter pilot on retainer and stuff to take him down there if the shit hits the fan. So, yeah, he's sort of... I think he's the most fascinating person in the world right now. But, yeah, sort of comically, sort of...
James Bond villain.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I was sort of wary of saying anything about Peter Thiel. Yeah.
He's listening.
He did it to Gawker. He could do it to Little Adams.
Well, just to finish off then, I mean, you've just said, putting your cards on the table, you don't necessarily think any of this stuff is going to happen. But having been and spent time with these people, you went into the project as a definite sceptic.
Mm.
Did any of it rub off?
Well, I don't think I ever came close to being converted or anything like that. But I did become more sceptical about my scepticism, I think. I mean, in a way, the least interesting thing for me as a writer is scepticism. Scepticism is just like, you know, it's not a particularly interesting thing to explore. Like, I think, yeah, in a way, obviously this stuff is quite remote and, you know, these people have very strange ideas that, you know, of course I'm sceptical about it. But I think what's most interesting to me is, like, why? Why is this a thing now? Why has this emerged at this particular moment in time? And what does it come out of, and what does it say to us about, like, our kind of broader faith in technology? So I think, like, for me, transhumanism, among all the many other things that it is and was always a way to kind of sort of probe our own slightly kind of sort of quasi-religious faith in technology and the prospect for progress through technology that our kind of culture is driven by in a more mainstream way. So, yeah, I think for me, like, transhumanism is sort of an extreme manifestation of sort of trends that are there in our culture anyway and in sort of capitalism, broadly speaking. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't think I was ever converted. But the thing for me is that, like, I was really drawn towards the ideas first and foremost, but, like, the people. Like, who are these people who believe that, who want to live forever and who think that it's desirable and achievable that we could become immortal? And, yeah, the thing I kept seeing was that they're strange people with strange ideas, but they come from a very human place. And, yeah, the sort of the thing that was revealed to me is, like, the fundamental humanity of these people. Some of it comes across in a comic way, but I hope I portray them in a way that is sort of respectful and sort of empathic.
Well, perhaps I'll ask that question in another way then. Did meeting these people and researching this book and writing it change your perspective on the life that we do have?
I think, like I say in the book, that I am going into this project to try and figure out what it means to be a machine, why people want to be a machine. But what actually happened to me was that I became more kind of confused about, like, what it actually is to be a human being. So, like, rather than sort of finding answers, I actually just deepened my own confusion. And there was a certain amount of sort of infection that happened with me, a certain amount of kind of, although I was never kind of convinced by these ideas, they did seep into my way of thinking about myself and way of thinking about the world. And, like, I just spent so long completely immersed in this sort of very mechanistic view of what a human being is and, you know, what it means to be alive in a body. And so I found myself kind of thinking of myself as a machine quite a lot. And that was something that I still get it every now and then. Like, I look at my hands and kind of go, what is this? This is like what's happening here? It's particularly when I'm writing, actually. Like, I have moments where I think of myself as just like a recording instrument, or if I'm doing an interview or whatever, or if I'm sort of trying to get work done, I think of myself in sort of quite instrumentalist terms, like I wrote 1,000 words today, you know, and maybe I'll write 1,500 words tomorrow. And there's this like sense that I can slip into. And I think people generally of yourself as kind of an input output mechanism or whatever. And so it really made me think about that stuff. And that stuff is not necessarily about transhumanism. It's part of the kind of logic of our culture or the logic of capitalism that we're sort of forced to think of ourselves in these quite mechanistic, quite instrumentalist terms. So in a way, the book is, you know, partly about that. And to the extent that this stuff got to me or changed how I think, it was through that, I think.
So I've been talking to Mark O'Connell. We've been talking about his book, To Be a Machine, Adventures Among Cyborgs, Utopians, Hackers, and the Futurists Solving the Modest Problem of Death, which is out now from Grant. And Mark, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.